Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This is movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussyfooting, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
turn, I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfuckers up made me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years, they're prejudiced. Foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Edition of Your World News on this September 24th, 2012. Got a great episode for you again, and this episode we're going to have a really in-depth dialogue and discussion, just a flat-out discussion with Canadian-based journalist, activist, and documentarian Asif Ismi to discuss, you know, his most recent radio documentary entitled The Latin American Revolution. And we'll also be discussing with him a new documentary that he has coming out in the coming weeks that is based around capitalism. It's simply called Capitalism is the Crisis. We'll also be discussing with him, many of the issues that he delves into in the Latin American Revolution, such as the upcoming elections in Venezuela, and why, Western, imperialist states such as the United States of America continue to see a major threat in the form of revolutionary, practices and policies that are emanating from, different places in Latin America, where people are starting to speak out and really let their political organizing, do a lot of the talking, such as places in Bolivia, El Salvador, we can, go, Nicaragua, Venezuela, obviously, and we, so it's going to be a great, great discussion, and we're looking forward to having Brother Asad Ismi on again. I'm joined in studio by the Your World News student correspondent, Tevin Baudov-Lynchen, who is joining me in studio right now, and Tim will be assisting in and many of the interviewing responsibilities that come with taking the hot seat as co-interviewer or co-host for Your World News, and Tim will continue to assume that role in the coming weeks and months and years, as Your World News continues to grow and grow. We grow because our listeners, boost us up, and they help water us by listening to our show and passing it on to their friends and comrades. And so that's how this program has become cultivated, because it is community oriented. You are the rightful owners of Your World News, the listener. This is your platform. This is your platform. So we look forward to you engaging with us and contacting us if you have different ideas for programs. And if you ever want to come on to the program, you always know that the call-in number for Your World News is always area code 347-945-5191. That's area code 347-945-5191, and includes this program. So Tim, welcome on once again, and welcome on many times in the future. I just want to ask you, allow you to say a couple words about who you are and anything else that comes off at the top of your mind.
Good afternoon. My name is Tim Baudov-Lynchen. As you already stated, I'm originally from Germany and moved to the U.S. 2 years ago to attend the University of Maryland. And since then, my mind has been completely open from the vast array of information that has gone contrary to the corporate media and its influence on even other parts of the world, and even my country, Germany and Switzerland, where I've lived, where these same issues that are ignored in the U.S. are also being ignored abroad. So one of those issues, obviously, is, for example, the Latin American Revolution, which we will hear about today. And so I'm looking forward to having Asad Ismi on the show today to speak on that and provide our listeners and myself with some insight about that.
Right, and so I appreciate it, and welcome on again. And one of the issues that we're going to deconstruct, in the coming weeks and months, that we've been continuing to deconstruct, is the contradictions of life in America, the contradictions of the first, black president, or phenotypically black or brown president in the United States of America, Barack Obama. Continue to deconstruct those contradictions and those narratives that are fed to most Americans in a very civ-like manner, filtering out any alternative perspective outside of the a Eurocentric elitist kind of a perspective, and the unfortunate thing is most Americans have no idea whatsoever that they're being fed this limited narrative ad nauseum. And so, therefore, their narratives and how they think about certain things are shaped by the corporate media, which, as we know, is a complete sycophantic apparatus of the U.S. United States government. That's why you'll have so-called liberal, shows and stations like MSNBC that champion the war drums in places like Libya and Afghanistan and now in Syria and soon to be Iran. I hope that that's not the case, but all indications look that the United States government and Israel will stop at nothing until they, create an act of war against an act of physical war against Islamic State of Iran. We know that they've already been put out their acts of war, or economic acts of war, with the brutal sanctions that they've levied on the Iranian government and its people. So we'll continue to deconstruct those narratives. You know, the same thing's going on with Hugo Chavez and his administration in Venezuela. And folks need to understand that prior to Hugo Chavez, there was a complete marginalization of Afro-Venezuelans and indigenous Venezuelans. They were completely marginalized, kept outside the margins by a completely, you know, Eurocentric, you know, government or governments that were in place before Chavez came into office. And now that Chavez is in office, his administration has provided things like universal health care, Mission Adentro, which is the healthcare system that has been implemented with the help of the Cubans throughout Venezuela. We see that they've virtually have eradicated illiteracy, you know, through the Chavez government. We see that that black and indigenous Venezuelans now have access to higher education, as does every other Venezuelan. They now have access to free healthcare, free education from nursery school all the way to their PhD if they choose to. So a range of things. So what's the threat? What's the threat, America? What is the threat? Well, we're going to get into the threat. I hope some of you already know that threat. But food sovereignty is another thing, the sustainable food and creating, you know, these sovereign, open spaces, you know, where Venezuelans can grow and sustain their own healthy, non-GMO infested food. It just been doing great things. And let me not just be spitting off without giving you some resources. A great documentary to get a hold of is Growing for Change. Growing for Change. That's a great recent documentary about the food revolution that's going on in Venezuela as well. And then and if you're not familiar with Venezuela and how they've been attacked by the U.S. physically, you know, internally, and how the U.S. has supported and financed coups in Venezuela, such as, you know, the coup that took out Chavez in the early 2000s. I believe it was 2000. A couple of good documentaries are Venezuela Rising, as well as Revolution Will Not Be Televised. So, with that being said, I want to, as usual, play Black Agenda Report, a commentary for the week. And this is Glenn Ford discussing the NDAA, which is the National Defense Authorization Act, which every person that is deciding to actually go ahead and vote this November, they need to know about this and need to know about the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama, and what he has supported. And not that Mitt Romney is any different, but that's the whole point. There are more similarities between them than there are differences, you know, and the sooner you realize that, the sooner you can start to wake up and start or help support strong third parties such as the Green Party and build upon some of those initiatives. So here we go with Glenn Ford discussing the National Defense Authorization Act.
It is not true that Barack Obama single-handedly destroyed the rule of law in the United States. The savaging of the Bill of Rights was, in effect, a tag-team effort between Obama and his predecessor, George Bush, two presidents united in a single-minded quest to remove all barriers to the imprisonment without trial or charge of persons anywhere in the world, including U.S. citizens. George Bush did the initial groundwork, interpreting the 2001 congressional mandate to strike militarily against Al-Qaeda as giving the president the power to hold foreign prisoners without charge in Guantanamo, and in theory, to treat American citizens the same way. But that was a stretch, and only a presidential opinion. George Bush knew that it would be very difficult to get a preventive detention bill through Congress. Democrats would raise holy hell, and protesters would call for his head. But Barack Obama accomplished what Bush could not. On New Year's Eve, Obama signed the preventive detention law as part of the National Defense Authorization Act. Under a black Democrat, the rule of law ceased to exist within U.S. borders. Obama had already declared the rest of the planet a killing ground. Then, back in August, a federal district judge in New York, Catherine Forrest, slapped a temporary restraining order on preventive detention, ruling on behalf of a group of activists and journalists who said they could be thrown in prison permanently simply for speaking or writing about groups targeted by the United States. What precisely and under the law constituted providing support for Al-Qaeda or related groups? Obama's Justice Department lawyers refused to say, claiming they had not thought the question through. Clearly, President Obama, like President Bush, wanted leeway to interpret the law any way he sees fit, so he can lock up whoever he wants, whenever he wants, for whatever reason, or for no stated reason at all. But Judge Forrest wasn't having it. On September 12th, she made her injunction permanent, ruling that Obama's preventive detention law was unconstitutional. For less than a week, the Bill of Rights returned to U.S. soil. But this past Monday, a federal appeals court judge put the Constitution back on hold, removing Judge Forrest's injunction on preventive detention. The entire three-judge appeals court will begin hearing the case on September 28th. Obama's lawyers say the government needs to be allowed to detain certain prisoners without charge or trial in Afghanistan. But Bruce Afron, the lawyer for the American plaintiffs in the case, thinks Homeland Security is gearing up to make lots of arrests of U.S. citizens in anticipation that Middle East protests will spread to American soil. That's the evil beauty of these Bush-Obama laws. They cut across international borders and render all the peoples of the world equal in one important respect. President Obama claims the right to kill each and every one of them, or lock them up forever on his own say-so. In that sense, Obama recognizes no legal difference between U.S. anti-war protesters and anonymous targets in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, or Somalia. All of our lives and freedom are subject to the whims of an American president. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
And that's the kind of narrative that you're simply not going to get from the corporate media anywhere in the U.S. And as I said before, the sooner we realize that, the better we are, the better we're all off. Because right now we have a bunch of people that are walking around that in essence are just programmed cyborgs that have been programmed by the U.S. government. And it's, as I said before, it's sycophantic corporate media system that puts out very limited narratives, omits large pockets of information so that most Americans continue to be programmed and completely oblivious to issues that directly affect them on a day-to-day basis. And so the NDAA, which was signed, you know, December 31st last year, you know, basically mandates the extrajudicial killings of Americans throughout the world. But to go deeper beyond that, extrajudicial killings of anybody, regardless of what so-called nationality they are, is completely wrong. But we understand that the U.S. doesn't need the NDA to do that. The U.S. kills, extrajudiciously kills innocent civilians virtually every single day, and has killed a million in Iraq, has killed tens of thousands in Afghanistan, killed tens of thousands by way of its strikes, as well as by its little you know, crony NATO forces in Libya, Somalia, Yemen. We can go on and on, and that's why we have Asad Ismi. We're going to have him on the show in one moment. This brother has done some amazing work in terms of lifting up the veil in terms of what Western governments, not just the U.S., but also even Canada, you know, the role that they played in destabilizing nations, you know, throughout the world, the role that they played of in terms of instigating and carrying out and sustaining war and plunder in places, you know, like Colombia, you know, where the Canadian mining corporations have just had a devastating impact on indigenous and Afro-Venezuelans. So, you know, we're going to discuss not just the Latin American Revolution, that may be a jumping off point, but we look forward to discussing with Asif Ismi also some issues that have to do with war and imperialism, you know, and starting off with the U.S.'s role in war and imperialism. Asif Ismi, as I indicated before, not only is he a friend of Your World News, he's our comrade, but he is an award-winning writer on international politics, specializing on the impact of U.S. and Canadian imperialism in the on the Global South. He's an international affairs correspondent for the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives Monitor, which is Canada's biggest left-wing magazine by circulation. Trust me, go Google right now, Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives Monitor. That's one of the places that Your World News routinely visits to get our news and information and commentary. And Brother Asif is the author of more than 100 articles, 9 reports, 5 radio documentaries, with another on the way. As I said, it's called Capitalism is a Crisis, and 2 books. His latest radio documentary, The Latin American Revolution, has been aired on 40 radio stations, including Your World News, where it's reached an audience of over 33 million people in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. And last but not least, Asif Ismi has written for 21 progressive unions and non-governmental organizations. His publications can be found on his website. And take note of this, people listening very closely. It's www.asadismi.ws. Once again, that's www.asadismi.ws. That is the website of Asif Ismi, our featured guest on Your World News. I'd like to welcome him on the show. Brother Asif, can you hear us?
Yes. Thank you, Brother Solomon. It's great to be on your show. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. So in studio, I have one of our student correspondents, Tim Bout of Lynchon, who will be helping me with the interview today. But I wanted to start off just by asking you, it's kind of a broad question, but it's a necessary question, asking you if you can give us some context detailing the nature of your recent radio documentary, The Latin American Revolution. You know, what is it all about? What can listeners expect to hear on that interview? I mean, on that documentary.
On the documentary, right. Well, the documentary is focused on the amazing progressive changes taking place in Latin America, which are ignored, and there's a news blackout about those amazing changes in the United States. And the fact that 11 left-wing governments have come to power in Latin America, one after another, toppling pro-U.S. Governments and neoliberal governments all over the continent and redistributing wealth in many significant ways to their people and redistributing power as well, implementing universal medical care programs, implementing all kinds of educational policies that bring free education to the whole population, and implementing all kinds of wealth redistribution policies such as land reform all over the continent, bringing into focus and emphasizing indigenous rights, the rights of women, the rights of the poor, and redistributing power through communal councils such as in Venezuela. So the documentary looks at all these in 4 episodes, and the first episode is about Venezuela, and the second episode is about Bolivia, the third episode is about Central America and the Caribbean, So it deals with El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Cuba. And the third episode is called Integration, Moving Towards a United Latin America, and it looks at the changes on the regional level and how Latin American countries are uniting and coming together in many different associations and many different organizations that unite almost all the countries of the continent, such as CELAC, which is the latest one formed, which unites 35 Latin American countries of the Caribbean, 35 Latin American countries and those of the Caribbean into one organization, and which pointedly leaves out the United States and Canada, which are, of course, imperialist powers. So the documentary looks at all these amazing changes towards the left and away from neoliberalism, away from capitalism in many ways, and it shows how Latin Americans are really leading the way towards creating an alternative to capitalism, an alternative to neoliberalism and the dictatorship of the United States and the Western powers.
Brother Assad, could you tell us a little bit about some of the gains in Venezuela since the initial election of Hugo Chavez?
Of course. Hugo Chavez has been ruling Venezuela now for 12 years. And now the latest election is coming up on October 7th, just a few days away. And so this is a very good time to talk about his record. And this is an amazing man, an amazing revolution in Venezuela, which has been changing that country since 1999 when he came to power. And the Chavez government, since it took power, has instituted universal medical care for everybody. Before that, 70% of the Venezuelans didn't have any medical care. It has instituted universal free education for everyone from kindergarten to PhD level, which it never had before. It has cut poverty in that country from 50% of the population to just 26% in a very short amount of time. It has redistributed wealth through land reform, through all kinds of subsidy programs for the people, such as government-owned supermarkets, which have cut the prices of goods, whatever you want to buy in a supermarket, by 40%. That's 40%. So massive subsidy to the masses, a huge help to them in terms of buying basic necessities, and also redistributed wealth through land reform. Significantly, since a lot of the land in Venezuela was owned by a few people, that has been a huge help to people in the countryside. Also redistributed wealth through PharmaCare program, where medicines are free, which is, of course, a huge help for millions of people. And so in many of these ways, Chavez has brought his country from a very generally poor country to a middle-class country and in many ways a well-off country. And we have to realize that Venezuela was a poor country in spite of the fact that it has one of the biggest deposits of oil in the world. And it was kept poor by these two political parties that were both neoliberal and that were ruling with the backing of the U.S., and they were looting the country, sending its oil wealth to the U.S., and impoverishing its people, and making sure that the wealth, the oil wealth, went to an elite of the of Venezuela, and then it went into U.S. and European banks. And so the Venezuelan people are being denied their basic resources, the oil that they owned. And the unemployment as well has been cut by the Chavez government. It used to be 20%, has been cut to 6%, which is an incredible achievement in itself. And Venezuela has moved up 4 positions on the United Nations Human Development Index. The healthcare program, one of the healthcare programs is called Mission Milagro, and it has restored eyesight to 300,000 Venezuelans. Mission Gregorio, another Health Program takes care of disabled people. Mission Sonrisa provides free dental care. And infant mortality in Venezuela has been reduced from 21 per 1,000 babies to 13, which is the third lowest rate in South America. So as you can see, Brother Chavez has done an enormous amount to literally transform his country.
Thank you. And you bring up some really important facts and data that are completely left off the radar of the vast majority of Americans. And as you were reading off that laundry list of accomplishments and gains achieved by the Chavez administration, you know, and most importantly, the people, why does the United States see these gains that have been achieved through Hugo Chavez and his administration, and as well as the progressive gains that have come out of other nations, you know, throughout Latin America, whether it's El Salvador or Bolivia, why does it see these gains as such a threat for what they stand for, what they being the United States stands for?
Firstly, because they can't order him about. They can't pick up the phone and say, hey, Chavez, you are a little slave, you know, do this and do that, which they can with their puppets in other parts of the world, for instance, in Pakistan or other countries like that. They can just pick up the phone and say, well, do this, and usually the Pakistanis will do it, you know. But Chavez is not like that, and so he's out of their control. So that's the first objection they have, that they can't control them. And then Chavez is determined to end what he calls savage capitalism, which is, of course, very much the U.S. is the biggest promoter of savage capitalism in all over the world. And what that means is, you know, taking from the poor and giving to the rich. So in many of the U.S.-dominated countries, you have a small elite controlling the resources, the economic wealth of that country. And this is what Chavez has changed almost overnight, is redistributed wealth and power to the people through the communal councils, which I didn't mention, which is basically decentralizing power to the community level. So this is what the U.S. really hates, is when the people in these countries get the power that they deserve to have, both economic power in terms of money and political power in terms of decision making. So that's what Chavez has done in both cases, is redistributed economic wealth and political power. And this is why they really hate him, because then it's very hard for the U.S. to control the country, because they don't control the elite, and then therefore they don't control the country. And those running the country are redistributing power, so they no longer are any elite. And it's the people of the country that are really running the show and having political and economic power. So the U.S. loses control of that country because the people of that country are now ruling it. And that's what's happening with Chavez. Because Chavez by himself is not doing all this. Chavez is merely an instrument of the poor who have elected him time and time again. He has won 3 elections, and then overall, he's won 8 elections, and if you include the legislative elections, and he's won 3 presidential elections. But he is really the voice of the poor, the instrument of the poor, who have taken back their country from this U.S.-dominated elite, which is looting it. And that's why they really hate Chavez, because he is one with the people. He represents the people, and he represents their taking back their country from U.S. domination. And to give you another way of putting it, this redistribution of wealth and power is the main reflection of the U.S. losing control over the country. And immediately after this happened, the U.S. started to try and overthrow him, overthrow Chavez, through a military coup 3 times, through economic destabilization, and through an assassination attempt. So two of these were military coup attempts. Then one of these was a military coup attempt, one was economic destabilization, and one was an attempt to assassinate him.
Brother Assad, as you mentioned, the U.S. is a country with rampant inequality, racism, and very specific form of capitalism that is has very little socialist programs in it. Could you talk about how capitalism and racism play a role in marginalizing much of Venezuela's indigenous and African population?
Oh yes. That was the problem. This is what was happening, was that, you know, anybody can have an election. An election doesn't mean anything. Election doesn't mean it's a democracy. You can rig an election. So let's look at the U.S. for a little bit of time. Is it a democracy? Not at all. As Mr. Greg Ballast, one a writer on the subject, he had a book called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and that describes the United States perfectly. It's not a democracy, it's a plutocracy where rich people just buy the politicians, just buy the government, and it's just the rich people competing against each other, you know, two different groups of rich people. So the poor or the middle class are totally marginalized, and they have very little choice in terms of who comes to power. They have very little control over that. So the one rich group of people just exchanges power with another, and that's not a democracy when it costs more than $1 billion to elect a president. That's not a democracy. It's just a plutocracy ruled by the rich. And what was happening in Venezuela was very similar to that before Chavez was elected. And since its formation, Venezuela has been dominated by a rich white elite descended from the Europeans who ruled over poor, indigenous, mestizo, meaning mixed European and native. This rich white elite, which is European, ruled over poor, indigenous, mestizo, and Afro-Venezuelan majority. So there are many people from Africa originally in Venezuela as well. So the U.S.-backed elite, the European elite, monopolized wealth and power and kept more than 50% of the Venezuelans mired in poverty, in spite of the fact that Venezuela is the world's fifth biggest oil producer. And with Washington's support, this elite proved itself to be one of the most corrupt in the world, looting the country's oil wealth for 40 years, increasingly marginalizing African Venezuelans, indigenous Venezuelans, and, you know, undermining any rights that they wanted. So when the people protested, when the Venezuelan indigenous people, the Afro-Venezuelans, poor Venezuelans, when they protested these injustices, they were killed by the police and the army. And due to this poverty and repression, a popular movement arose, which elected Hugo Chavez president in 1998. And then he launched what he called the Bolivarian Revolution, named after the liberator of South America, Simon Bolivar. And the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela signified the start of the Latin American Revolution, because this revolutionary wave spread to all of South America and Latin America and turned one country after another in a left-wing direction, with left-wing governments being elected all over the continent.
Thank you, Saad. Brother Saad, you recently sent me an article that I found really, really interesting and informative, and it was through that article it was discussing the strong pro-woman policies that have also come out of the Chavez administration and why so many women in Venezuela support Chavez. Can you tell our listeners, kind of give them a sketch in terms of what kind of policies, what kind of pro-women policies have come out of the Chavez administration, and how that has lent itself forward towards decreasing the inequality, the gender inequality that previously existed?
Right. Yeah. Sure. The Chavez administration is the most pro-woman administration that Venezuela has ever had. And even to the extent of passing, making it law that women who work in the household, who are housewives, should be paid a salary for their work. And that has been given to them as well by the government. And that's the first time this has ever happened, as far as I know, in any country in the world, that women who work at home have been given the actual salaries. That is truly incredible. And then, of course, the infant mortality rate, being brought down immensely has been a huge help to women, obviously. Before that, because of the poverty, it was difficult to give birth. It was difficult to get help for that. It was difficult to get help with children after they were born as well. And all that has been mitigated by the government with all kinds of policies favoring women. There is, of course, the medical care, expansion of medical care to the entire population, which has been, I think, in my opinion, the best thing in terms of pro-women policies, because then the women do not have to worry about their health. They can focus on their work, on supporting their families. Then they don't have to worry about the health of their children either, because the doctor will be there. He'll take care of the children immediately. There's a doctor in every neighborhood now, whom you can go to quickly. You don't even have to go to the hospital. So that is a huge burden taken off their shoulders, the care of children. In terms of education, it's been a huge help for women as well, that they can go to school to improve their prospects and careers. Children can go to school for free as well. They don't have to spend money on that. They don't have to worry about that. They don't have to work for that. It's all free. Then there is the giving to women of political power, literally making it as easy as possible for them to participate in the political future of the country, and that is through communal councils. And you will see that many of the people who participate in these communal councils, which are at the neighborhood level, and make very important decisions about what will be done in the neighborhood, what will be built there, what will the priorities will be in terms of spending money on projects in that neighborhood. So they are now performing the function of municipal councils at the neighborhood level in Venezuela. So they have important power. They have important money resources in terms of, and they decide what the money should be spent on in many areas in Venezuela. And many of these members of these communal councils are women. So that's a very important advance for women in terms of taking political power and making important decisions all over the country in terms of what public money will be spent on.
Brother Saad, thank you. You also mentioned earlier that Venezuela was kind of an inspiration for other Latin American countries to take on a more progressive political agenda. So that being said, in what way has the Latin American revolution in places like Venezuela supported the struggle to end imperialism in other parts of the world?
Definitely, they have. Firstly, by providing a very good example for opposing the U.S. successfully. So when you have 11 Latin American governments led by Venezuela rising up to defeat U.S. intervention and imperialism all over Latin America, that in itself inspires governments all over the world to do the same. And so we have seen the revolutions in the Middle East taking place recently in Egypt and Tunisia, which were very long-term U.S. puppets and were ruled for 30 years by the dictator Mubarak in Egypt. And overnight he was gone. Overnight he was thrown. And those people who did that were inspired by Chavez, were inspired by Venezuela, and were inspired by the Latin American Revolution to do that. And they thought, well, it can happen in Venezuela. Why can't it happen in Egypt? And the same thing with the Tunisians. They were inspired by changes, by the progressive changes in Latin America as well. Now, we can, it's arguable now which direction those governments are going now, because they are both fundamentalist governments in Egypt and Tunisia. So that's, in my opinion, that's not a positive thing at all. But at least they're elected. They're elected by the Egyptian people and the Tunisian people. And presumably, if the left organizes in these countries better than it has up to this point, presumably they can get elected in the future if there's another viable election there. So certainly those changes are being inspired. They may not go in a direction immediately that we like, but at least that dictator has been got rid of, who was very pro-U.S.
Right. Thanks a lot. Brother Saad, can you tell us about a lot of work that you've been doing around this issue, the role that Canadian mining corporations have played in places like Colombia in the exploiting of minerals there, and also the nefarious role that they have played in displacing indigenous and indigenous people as well as Afro-Colombians?
In Colombia, you mean?
Yeah, Colombia.
Right. I recently published a report called Profiting from Repression, Canadian Investment in and Trade with Colombia. And so it focuses a considerable amount on the role of Canadian mining companies in Colombia and their alliance with the government in Colombia, which is essentially a death squad government. And it runs death squads all over the country and kills anyone they don't like and anyone who opposes them. And so the Canadian mining companies are there with the cooperation with a government like this, which in itself is a violation of international law and really makes them complicit in genocide, which the Colombian government is committing against its own people. And the Colombian government, through its death squads, kills about 5,000 to 6,000 people a year and takes over their land, pushes them out, displaces them. There are about 4 million displaced Colombians in the country, and their land is then grabbed up by the government and then given to the mining companies. And many of these mining companies, in fact, the largest number of mining companies in Colombia are Canadian, and they include Gran Colombia Gold Corporation, Cosigo Corporation. There are about 26 of them, and they also include Gray Star Mining, that was the former name, and now it's called Eco Oro Minerals, and they include many other mining companies, about 26 of them, so which you can see from my report. If you just go to my website, you can access my report there. So the whole point of the mining is to really loot and steal the resources from the people of Colombia. And then the resources are taken over by the Canadian mining companies, which give a cut to the Colombian government and then keep most of the money. They take it out of the country. And the Colombian people are being killed by the thousands. Their resources, the resources really belong to them. Their gold and their minerals are being taken, stolen by these companies and taken out of the country. And the people are denied their land, they're denied their basic necessities, they are impoverished by the having their land taken over, and then they're forced to migrate to urban ghettos in usually the capital, Bogota, and live in misery and poverty.
Have you seen any difference between the previous Uribe administration and that of the present administration within Colombia of President Santos?
No, not really. But Santos is much cleverer, and the objectives are the same, is to loot the people and kill them and steal their resources and then, you know, give some to the mining companies and keep some for themselves. But in terms of Santos, his rhetoric sounds more progressive. You know, that he is more careful in the use of his language and his public relations, and he is more careful to cultivate relations with the, you know, because so much of Latin America has gone left-wing, because there are 11 left-wing governments, and he can't afford to be isolated. And he can't also afford to oppose so many left-wing governments. He's just there by himself. And now it is the right-wing governments in Latin America that are isolated, not the left wing. It used to be the other way around. It used to be that Cuba was isolated, and then the other governments were right wing. But now, no, it's the opposite now. So if you're right wing now, you really have to be afraid for your life, because all these left wing governments surround you, and there's no way that you can, explicitly be a U.S. puppet and explicitly carry out these right-wing policies. You have to hide it under rhetoric of progressive-sounding language, and that's what Santos does, is he had a rhetoric of progressive-sounding language that he uses to obscure his right-wing actions. And so that's the difference between him and Uribe.
Brother Assad, earlier you mentioned the long list of positive things that Hugo Chavez has done in Venezuela that we here in America on the corporate news don't really hear anything about. Here in America, in general, the media portrays Chavez as a dictator, as someone that should be looked down upon. But given all these things you've told us, how has the Western media played a role in a campaign of disinformation in places like Venezuela?
Right. Well, as you know, the Western media comes from the same corporate interests that any other corporation has. You know, all those Western media, they are corporations, and many of them are owned by defense corporations or military contractors like General Electric. So their corporate interests, their class interests is the same as the class interests represented by Obama and by the U.S. administration. So they have the same interest in keeping the wealth and power concentrated in an elite in Venezuela so they can benefit through their connections and through their domination of that elite. And when the wealth and power are distributed widely, as now in Venezuela, it's not in their interest either to have this done. So they have been carrying out mainly the U.S. administration's anti-Chavez rhetoric and anti-Chavez propaganda. They have been carrying that out in their newspapers and magazines and TV shows on a very big level. So that's no surprise at all. And they call him a dictator, and he has won 3 elections. So how is he a dictator? He has won 8 elections altogether. How is that dictatorial? Meanwhile, in the U.S., we see that there has not been even one fair election, as far as I can see, in their entire history. Their entire history has been an election of one rich group, contesting elections with another. I mean, the people have not really had any say in these elections whatsoever. And let me refer you to the report, the recent comments and the recent remarks of ex-President Jimmy Carter, the U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who said, and this man, I'm not a fan of Jimmy Carter at all. I don't like him at all. I think he was another imperialist president, just like all the other U.S. presidents. But since leaving the presidency, he's not president anymore, since leaving, his specialty has been monitoring elections all over the world. And he has monitored 92 elections. His Carter Center. And his comment, his remark is that the Venezuelan electoral system is the best in the world. That's what he said. It is the best electoral system in the world. And I was really surprised to hear him say that, but that's exactly his remark. And he says that the United States has one of the worst electoral systems in the world due to the dominance of money, due to the dominance of the capitalist class, always pouring their money into the electoral system and utterly corrupting it.
That's right. And could you follow up by, since they want to put out this myth about Chavez being a dictator, can you tell our listeners exactly what the scope of media, the majority of the media, looks like in Venezuela? Because a lot of people don't understand how freely the opposition have to operate and put their lies and disinformation and their propaganda out there. What does the media consist of in Venezuela?
Right. That's a very good point, too. That, again, you know, we don't have much of an opposition media in the U.S. either. They all back one or the other candidate, you know, one rich man's candidate. And I'm saying rich man because I don't think women have much economic power in the U.S. either. And let's see what the media looks like in Venezuela. And it's mostly privately owned, it's mostly right-wing, and it's mostly anti-Chavez. And they're allowed to say whatever they want. They can criticize him as much as they want, and they do all the time. They come up with all kinds of lies against Chavez. They make up all kinds of propaganda and complete falsehoods against him. And yet, hardly any of them have lost their license. Hardly any of them have been shut down. hardly any of them have been persecuted by the government, and they can really get away with a lot. It's a very free media. It's a very right-wing media. It's very anti-Chavez media. And the government has done very little to shut them down or inhibit them in any way whatsoever.
That's right.
And let me just add, not only the media, but look at the candidate of the opposition today, Capriles Radonsky. Just look at him. I mean, forget about what the media said. This guy, the right-wing leader, Enrique Capriles Radonsky, he was the one during the coup against Chavez, which was instituted by the U.S. in 2002 to overthrow him. During this coup, Mr. Radonsky participated in an illegal terrorist assault on the Cuban embassy in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela. And there he is running as the opposition candidate.
That's right. I mean,
the government did not even put this man in jail, which he deserves to be. You know,
exactly.
And they're letting him be the candidate in the presidency. I mean, just think about that.
Yeah, and the similarities with the U.S. Are abound, because Capriles, he's got strong, like very strong roots with the oppressive government that is in Israel.
Has devoted, said
that if he's president, he's going to open up, you know, lines of collaboration between Venezuela and Israel. You want to talk about that?
Totally. And so here's a man who is a terrorist, who participated in a terrorist assault on a foreign embassy, the Cuban embassy in 2002, and yet he was not put in jail by the government. So aside from the letting the media have all the freedom they could possibly want, the government has not even prosecuted known terrorists. And not only have they not prosecuted them, they're letting them run in elections against the sitting president himself.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's totally shocking to me that this man has been allowed to be a presidential candidate.
That's right.
I mean, the man is clearly a terrorist, you know. So it's the amount of freedom available in Venezuela is amazing. Really,
it is.
Amazing.
It really is. Can you talk about to our audience? I want to shift things just slightly, because you also have a wealth of information and knowledge behind, like, truly what is going on in places like Libya and Syria. Can you talk to our listeners about, because, you know, there's now much to do about the U.S. ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens, and, you know, his untimely death in Libya with, you know, three other individuals. Can you talk about, a lot of folks don't know the role he played in the finance coup, the U.S. finance coup that overthrew Gaddafi, and what work he was doing, you know, financing the so-called rebels on the ground, which were nothing but a ragtag bunch of terrorists that were financed by the U.S. and Western nations. But can you give us, and I know it's a loaded question, but take as much time as you want to kind of break down, you know, what went on in Libya, what happened in Libya a couple weeks ago, how that was not unforeseen. It's something called blowback, and you know, why this was blowback, and what's going on in Libya, I mean Syria as well. Who's financing these rebels in Syria, and what is the end game of financing them?
Right. Well, no surprise there with the Ambassador Stevens being killed, because if you go around the country killing 50,000 people, which is what the U.S. did in Libya, to overthrow Gaddafi, then no surprise if you are the one killed as well. No surprise there at all. And those people who are saying in the U.S. that he was such a nice guy, well, how could he be such a nice guy if he's killing 50,000 Libyans? How can that be a definition of a nice guy? So some of the Libyans who are fundamentalists, and the U.S. has a history of supporting fundamentalists when it's convenient for them. you know, when the fundamentalists can carry out U.S. Favorable policies, then it's fine for the U.S. to support them, such as in Afghanistan they've done, such as in Syria they're doing. So they like to use the fundamentalists to overthrow secular regimes that they cannot control completely, such as Gaddafi or Assad in Syria. And then when the fundamentalists, many of whom don't like the U.S., are also using the U.S. to carry out their objectives, when they turn around, they shoot somebody from the U.S., then the U.S. starts complaining. So, of course, there's no justification for that complaint, because the U.S. knows that many of the fundamentalists are opposed to the U.S. As well as being opposed to the secular government in power, which the U.S. is trying to overthrow. So certainly it's blowback in that sense in the case of Libya. And in the case of Libya, we can see what a destructive war the U.S. imposed on that poor country. And what was the reason? Gaddafi was a secular leader. So if the U.S. is opposed to fundamentalism, which they keep saying they are, and they're opposed to Al-Qaeda, this fundamentalist group and that fundamentalist group, they keep emphasizing that, in that case, they should have supported Gaddafi. They should have. Then he would have ensured that the fundamentalists would have remained out of power. No, they didn't do that. They supported the fundamentalists against Gaddafi. So how can they be against fundamentalism if they are encouraging fundamentalists to overthrow a secular leader in the Middle East? How can they be against fundamentalism? So they can't make that claim at all anywhere in the world. And they've done the same thing in Afghanistan, that they used fundamentalists to overthrow a secular pro-communist government they didn't like. So that aspect of U.S. policy has been fairly consistent, of using fundamentalists to overthrow secular governments they don't like. But in the case of Gaddafi, the differences between the U.S. and Gaddafi were seemingly minimal, because Gaddafi had gone along with U.S. dictates to about 90% of the extent that they wanted, whatever they wanted. They wanted him to privatize his economy, he did. They wanted him to stop his nuclear program, he did. They wanted him to let in all the multinational corporations take over his oil sector, he did that. So British Petroleum was running most of his oil sector, and the American companies had full access to his oil sector. So what was there to complain about there? In that economic sense, nothing at all. Then Gaddafi is so generous to the West that he even gave $10 million in campaign funding to Sarkozy's campaign in France, the ex-president of France, Sarkozy, the right-wing guy. So Gaddafi is completely in bed with the Western neoliberal corporate elite, literally in bed with them, so close to them that he's giving them this $10 million. So what was the complaint against him that they had to overthrow him? The only thing that they had against Gaddafi was when the Tunisian and the Egyptian revolutions happened, he wouldn't let them use Libya as a base, as a military base, to counteract those revolutions and to send in soldiers and special forces from there into Egypt and Tunisia. And if you notice on the map, if you look at the map, the only country with borders on Tunisia and on Tunisia and Egypt both, the only country like that is Libya.
Right.
So, strategically speaking, the U.S. really needed Libya to become a base, a military base, overnight. And Gaddafi, that is the only thing Gaddafi would not give them, is that access in military terms. And he said, I can't do that, so they overthrew him because of that. But now they've made a huge mess of things by doing that. They've destabilized that whole country, that whole region, and the fundamentalist groups. There's so many of them that they used in Libya, that the West used in Libya. They financed them. They trained them. They encouraged them to overthrow Gaddafi. And now they can't control them, because it's not just one group. It's a number of different fundamentalist groups that hate each other, you know. Just because you're a fundamentalist doesn't mean you like other fundamentalists, you see?
Right.
Because it's the same as two mullahs, you know, and mullah is a person who knows the Quran, who's not knows the Quran, but has read the Quran. Now, in Pakistan, for instance, which is a Muslim country, you can't find two mullahs who agree with what is the correct interpretation of the Quran. You can't even find two mullahs who agree on that, let alone find two fundamentalist groups who like each other, you know. So they are all divided as well. They say, you know, we are the true Islamists. And then the other ones say, no, we are the true ones. You are a bunch of infidels. You know, they hate each other's guts even more than sometimes they hate the left wing. So they don't get along either. So if you back a bunch of fundamentalists, you know that soon after they win, or if they win, they will then start fighting with each other. And that will mean that they will probably kill the American who's supporting some other group and not them, you see. So the fundamentalist who killed Stevens may have felt that, well, he's supporting some other fundamentalist group, not us, so let's kill him, you know. So that's how they think.
That's right.
So that's no surprise at all. And now they're doing the same stupid policy in Syria, as we can see. They are backing a bunch of disparate, heterogeneous fundamentalist groups there as well. There's the Free Syrian Army. There's some other army on the ground that does not recognize the authority of the Free Syrian Army, right? Then there are different groups within Syria in different neighborhoods and different areas who don't recognize anybody's authority and who are fundamentalists and who are fighting, who will be fighting with each other the moment if they are victorious over the Assad regime, you see. And the Americans are doing the same thing there, you know, financing different groups that will end up fighting with each other, and that will probably end up killing the Americans as well, you know. So that'll be no surprise either. When you create, I mean, you reap what you sow. You know, when you create chaos and instability and war, then definitely your own, the Americans' own representatives will end up getting killed, undoubtedly. But this situation in Syria is much more alarming than the one in Libya or the one they created in Afghanistan, because in this case, Russia and China have both warned the U.S., and this is the first time that both countries have done this, that if they do this, if they remove Assad, the regime of Assad, there will be nuclear war. They have said that to the U.S. There will be nuclear war. And so they're basically drawing the line there at the Syrian regime change and saying that, you know, if you go through with it, the Chinese oil supply will be threatened, because after Syria, the country that they are going to target is Iran. And so the Syrian takeover is really meant to isolate Iran and then to be able to easily take over Iran. And Iran supplies 11% of China's oil. So all these things are really aimed at Russia and China and keeping them under Western domination. And the takeover of Syria is very much part of that. And Russia and China know this, that their oil routes will be threatened, their access to oil supplies will be threatened. And so they've warned the U.S. That there will be nuclear war if you take over Syria. But that has no effect on the U.S. They're continuing with their vicious policy in Syria, taking over the country. And this is going to taking the world towards a nuclear catastrophe, definitely.
Right. And I wanted to, you know, grab something, because also we looked at Libya, you know, during Gaddafi, especially the last, you know, few years before he was brutally murdered, you know, on television.
Yeah.
You know, it was the highest living, you know, living standards on the continent of Africa, with, you know, free education and healthcare and so forth. And now it's in chaos. People, as you mentioned, at least 50,000 people have lost their lives. It's you know, and it's just in rubble. And the U.S., as you know, got out there, no help, and you know, it just shows you that they couldn't give a damn about the civilians that were being killed during their strikes, during NATO strikes, and they couldn't give a damn about the civilians that are on the ground now any more than they could give a damn about the black Libyans and black Africans that were being targeted by those terrorist thugs that the U.S. was supporting. Asad, what do you think? And I hope it doesn't come to fruit, but what do you think would happen if the U.S. and Israel start war and start bombing Iran? What could we see coming out of that?
I think very much the possibility of nuclear catastrophe in that case is very high, that the Chinese and the Russians will probably nuke the U.S. and the West in general, because India as well has intercontinental ballistic missiles now that can reach Europe. You know, so if the Western elite wants a war, they will get one, and they'll get one that they'll never be able to win. And of course, they have nuclear weapons as well. So it's very conceivable that the whole of humanity will be destroyed by this constant Western warmongering. And their attack on Iran will bring that on, definitely.
Brother Assad, in your upcoming radio documentary, Capitalism is the Crisis, what can listeners expect to hear and learn about, but also what are some ways that capitalism literally causes death and destruction around the world in terms of economic starvation, in terms of funding wars, in terms of private prisons that we see all over the U.S., where people are literally being put to death, sometimes slowly over a long period of time, because of the system of capitalism in this country?
Oh, very much so. In the documentary, I have four episodes, Capitalism is War, in which we deal with Iraq and Afghanistan, then Capitalism is Poverty, which we deal with India, and we just deal with India, actually, because India has the biggest group of poor people in the world. And then we have the third episode is Capitalism is Environmental Destruction, in which we deal with the tar sands in Canada, the biggest, most destructive environmentally destructive industrial project in the world today. And we deal with Bangladesh, which is literally sinking into the sea because of capitalism and because of the luxury-loving lifestyle of the Western elite, and sinking into the sea because of the rising water levels, because of the melting of the polar ice cap, which is because of the carbon dioxide buildup, increasing carbon dioxide release into the atmosphere, most of which comes from the Western industry. So, and the last episode is called Capitalism is the Crisis, which is about the financial crisis, and it deals with the U.S. and Europe. So certainly, for the last 500 years or 600 years, from 1500 to 2100 now, capitalism has, I would say, has been responsible for about the deaths of about 600 million people at least. Between 600 million and a billion, because there have been estimates that up to 500 million Africans were killed in the slave trade, because as you know, the slave trade was going on for 300 to 400 years, and so for every one slave who was brought to the United States or brought to the Caribbean, five people were killed along the way, from the interior of Africa where they were brought. They didn't make it to the coast because they were treated so brutally, and so they died. So for every one, there are five Africans who were killed by the slave trade. And then we have 200 million Indians being killed by British colonialism over 200 years. So this was due to very high taxes on the farmers, their impoverishment, their starving to death, and the breakdown of the rural economy, which the British ensured in India. So 200 million Indians were killed in that manner under British rule. So that's 1 million Indians for every year of colonialism, of British colonialism in India. So that's 700 million people if you include if you put together the Indians and the Africans. And then we go to the Latin Americans, where 200 million native Latin Americans or indigenous people in that area called Latin America today were killed by Spanish and Portuguese colonialism. So that makes altogether 900 million people. So capitalism has left a very vicious legacy of a massive genocide all over the world, of close to a billion people being killed in the last 600 years. And that is an incredible number. And it brings to mind what Marx said about capitalism, Karl Marx said about capitalism, that it comes into the world bathed in blood, literally, bathed in the blood of the poor and the oppressed. And in that sense, it has been a very vicious, very violent, and genocidal system.
Jeez, thank you for that. That's, golly. So when will Capitalism, the Crisis, be officially released?
Oh, in December. We're aiming for December because December 21st has been declared the end of Capitalism Day by the Bolivian president, Evo Morales. And he is, of course, very anti-capitalist. And we are trying to release it around that time. Of course, it doesn't mean that that is the end of Capitalism Day. It hasn't ended yet. But certainly, Evo Morales is right in the sense that the system is completely in decline. There's no doubt about it. It is in big trouble. It is under massive pressure. And there's no doubt it's breaking down. As we can see in the U.S. And in Europe, the system is lurching from one crisis to another, and it is unable to get out of this massive recession and depression that it's in right now. And it's creating more and more unemployment, poverty, and it's definitely headed towards a breakdown.
For those who are kind of short-sighted because they've kind of been programmed to only see things through a limited lens that has been provided to them by U.S. propaganda. Can you kind of explain to folks what, like, you know, so someone might be saying, oh, you know, well, if capitalism, you know, erodes and eviscerates, then what? And so can you explain to folks what a more socialist or a socialist environment, a socialist society, what it would look like? What kind of things would it bring about to the average person who has been marginalized, but you know, but quite frankly, doesn't even realize that they've been marginalized and been kept out of the loop of even things like healthcare being a human right? What would a socialist society look like?
Right. That's a very good question, because one thing that capitalism robs many people of and could be argued as the most important thing is their imagination. Their imagination to create a better world, to create a more humane world, so that when the propaganda machine gets into people's minds, it robs them of that very ability to imagine alternatives, let alone create them. And so we have to have a conscious effort to do that. And one example is what is happening in Latin America with all these 11 nations coming together in different regional groupings, such as the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, such as ALBA, which is the Bolivarian Alternative for the Peoples of the Americas, which is 8 countries coming together and forming a trading group, which is not based on money at all. It's based on a virtual currency called Sucre, and it's not based on making profits at all for any country. It's based on providing for the development needs of the people of each country. So, for instance, in the grouping, Cuba and Venezuela will not use any money for trading at all. They will trade their people, doctors, for resources such as oil. So Venezuela, which has a lot of oil, will give Cuba oil, and Cuba will give Venezuela doctors, 45,000, 46,000 doctors. Cuba has given Venezuela, and Venezuela gives Cuba oil. So there you go. You have no money exchange, so there is no real capitalism at all. You have basic needs being fulfilled, the medical care needs of Venezuela being fulfilled by Cuba. Then the basic needs of Cuba for oil, for you know, running their economy is being fulfilled. There's not much, as far as I can see, there's no profit being made. So capitalism is being eliminated there completely. And yet people are trading, but they're trading in a humane manner which fulfills their basic needs. So there you have a concrete example of a regional grouping of 8 or 9 countries that have completely done away with capitalism.
Brother Assad, on behalf of Solomon, myself, and Your World News, I want to thank you for being on the show with us today. It was a pleasure and an honor to have you. We really learned a lot. And I just wanted to let you know that Your World News is always going to be a platform that will welcome you as a guest, and we look forward to working with you in the future in terms of talking about your documentary or any other work that you're doing. So it would be a pleasure to have you again, and I hope you have a good one.
Thank you very much. Let me say it was a pleasure and honor to talk to you as well, and thank you very much for your support, and I really appreciate that, and talking to both Solomon and you. It's been a great pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, brother.
Goodbye.
So, Tim, that was just a fantastic just array of information that was provided by Brother Assad Ismi. And for folks that really are not familiar, just please, you know, go to his website. We gave it out. Go to his website. Look it up. It's an array of information. He has his previous documentaries, such as The Ravaging of Africa, which is kind of just displays in vivid yet horrific, you know, sight, you know, of the legacy of abuse and destruction and plunder and exploitation that the West has thrown at the continent of Africa and her people, as well as her diaspora. That's a really strong, you know, strong documentary, as well as all of his documentaries that his radio documentaries that I've listened to in the past, and I'm happy to say that we've even posted some of them on Your World News. It seems like I think we may have a caller on line one. I don't know if they have a question. Caller line one, do you have a question or comment? Hello? Okay. If not. With that being said, I want to play a clip for you, Tim, and for you and the rest of our listeners. I want folks to really listen to this. This is, you know, this is kind of what Oscar was talking about. He talked about some of what is displayed on this news commentary by way of Glenn Ford and Black Agenda Report. And I really want folks to understand the gravity of this issue and the situation that's going on right now globally, in a perpetual state of war, and this war is being caused by Euro-American and Western governments that are really infringing on people's sovereignty, for their own self-interest, and they are taking lives. I mean, for a second, please, I beg you to please listen to what I'm saying and understand the gravity of this. We're talking about countless lives of men, women, children, and elderly that are just being obliterated directly by way of the U.S. and other Western nations, or indirectly by the U.S. and other countries by way of the financing of these death squads that are just wreaking havoc through Libya, Syria, and other places. So I want to play this. This is called Blowback, and this is from Glenn Ford and Black Agenda Report. And on the other end, we'll get Tim's closing comments, and we'll put a cap on this important episode.
The United States and its allies have set the stage for the mother of all blowbacks, a long period of convulsions in the Muslim and Arab world that will ultimately lead to America's expulsion from much of the region. The reason it is so easy to read the handwriting on the wall is that we've been watching the scenario unfold for three decades, ever since the last years of the Jimmy Carter administration, when the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan spent billions to create a worldwide Muslim jihadi army and unleashed it on the Soviets and their allies in Afghanistan, plunging that country into endless war. When these Muslim warriors turned on the United States, or, depending on your vantage point, when the United States turned on them, we experienced the first blowback. The American public, shocked and traumatized, gave first a Republican and then a Democratic president all the guns and money and extra constitutional powers they demanded to push back against the Muslims, who had not long ago been U.S. allies. The war planners in Washington figured they could live with the way events had turned out. After all, al-Qaeda and its Salafist brethren were in no position to challenge U.S. dominance in the world, not any place that really counted, and their mere existence provided the U.S. war machine with a purpose in life, an excuse to subvert and wage low-level war against those nations that refused to toe the U.S. line. And then came the so-called Arab Spring, and with it the terrifying prospect that Muslims in North Africa and the Middle East might take control of their own destinies and the oil and natural gas that goes with it. Democracy means death to U.S. imperialism. Research pollsters report that, on average, only 15% of Egyptians, Jordanians, Lebanese, Pakistanis, and Turks have a favorable view of the United States. That's down from 25% in 2009, when Barack Obama came into office. If the Arab and Muslim street came to power, the United States would be run out of that whole section of the planet, and Washington knows it. When Tunisia and Egypt erupted, the United States and Europe played the only cards they had. They brought in massive air power and called out the jihadi dogs of war in an unprovoked attack on Libya. Almost simultaneously, the Euro-Americans and the royal criminals of the Persian Gulf armed and financed a jihadi assault against Syria as Washington and Israel stepped up their low-level war against Iran. As Temple University's Professor Tony Monteiro has pointed out, the whole rationale for the U.S. war on terror is a lie, the facts turned backwards. Washington claims it's engaged in a long twilight war against non-state actors, terrorists, who seek to subvert and overthrow existing governments. In reality, it is the Americans who deploy non-state jihadi actors to overthrow governments that Washington doesn't like. However, in doing so, the West has once again empowered fundamentalist forces that will inevitably turn against Washington, the greatest infidel of all. Last week's protests are only a small foretaste of what is to come, a blowback of such intensity that the foundations of empire will crack and crumble. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
And before I get your comment, Tim, this is what Glenn Ford just laid out. History tells us that what he just said, you know, could very well mean the harbinger of things to come. And history tells us that based on the U.S.'s actions in places like Iran in 1953, in which they financed, you know, it was the CIA's, you know, first, you know, quote unquote, official coup that that sent in, you know, Teddy Roosevelt's grandson, you know, Kermit Roosevelt, you know, to go into Libya and to orchestrate and finance and organize an all-out, you know, coup that overthrowing the democratically elected populist, you know, leader of Iran at that time, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, simply because, you know, he had other intentions for Iran's vast oil reserves. You know, he wanted to nationalize the oil reserves, take it out of the hands of the British, and put the oil reserves in the hands of the Iranians themselves, and therefore the revenue would find its way to the Iranians. And so I say that to say, you know, so it happened. They installed the Shah, took out Mohammad Mossadegh, installed the Shah. The Shah had a bloody reign, you know, until 1979, had a bloody reign, and used his secret police called the Savak. These secret police, you know, killed, maimed, murdered, you know, and the like, and U.S. didn't mind anything about it. That was their boy. That was their man, the Shah. And so what happens in 1979, the Iranian Revolution, the Iranian hostage crisis, the rest is history. These folks don't have short-term memories, Tim. They don't have short-term memories. They remember very much when something was bad to them. Just like if someone came to us right now and punched us in the nose as hard as they could, exploded our nose, we're not going to forget that. We're not going to forget that for some time. We're not going to forget that. And so you see what happened in 1979, and so the U.S. doesn't ever, ever, ever learn its lessons in terms of what you do in other people's countries in terms of bringing terror and plunder and exploitation to them. Sometimes, you know, as folks have said, chickens do come home to roost. And it's just a very unfortunate thing because it puts innocent lives in the trajectory of these imperialist wet dreams, these imperialist, conquests of wealth and riches to be shared by just the elitists and those in power in these imperialist countries. And so it puts innocent lives in America at risk. It puts the young African American man who joined the military because of socioeconomic living standards and or a lack thereof at risk. It puts tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of innocent civilians in other countries at risk, simply because they want to carry out their this anti-humane, anti-human being, anti-justice, pro-death, and very much in many cases racist actions, of war, in these countries, all for self-serving reasons, and so I hope that it stops. I hope the Iran is not invaded. I hope that the U.S. and its Middle Eastern and Western sycophants that are in that area financing these rebels, I hope they get the hell out of there and allow the people of Syria to resolve this democratically, to resolve this peacefully, without Western intervention, without, those that support the West, without that intervention, and get out. And we hope it stops dead in its tracks, so that life can resume and people can rebuild their lives, and hopefully the U.S. and those that have caused this carnage, dole out, massive amounts of reparations that really can never solely do justice because you can't bring back the lives that are lost. But that's the only thing that we can hope and more importantly fight and struggle for, and that's what Your World News is about. It's for that struggle, for truth, justice, and equality, not just within the U.S. but the world over. I could go on and on and on, but this is what has happened in the past. The U.S. calls it, Tim, they call it blowback. It's called blowback. It is a term that comes out of the CIA, and in his brilliant series, Chalmers Johnson, in his book Blowback, and that trilogy that goes along with it. Chalmers Johnson, who was a former CIA analyst, explained what blowback is, and they know this. The U.S., the Pentagon, they know this. They say, yo, when we go into all these other countries and destabilize them, for our own good, these folks are going to get mad, and they may try to bring this battle to us, and where we are on our territory, or in other places where where we're at, and so they know it. So it's very sick. So they know that innocent lives may be put to risk, or likely to put to risk, but still they do it. They come up with the term blowback. It's almost like when they, go into these wars, they know they have actuaries that work on these numbers and say, we're probably going to have, X amount of thousands of people, killed, we'll call it collateral damage, but we're going to have this many civilian lives probably that are going to be lost. But, you know, we're going to go and do it anyways. It is the same exact thing regarding this. And you know, coup after coup after coup from Guatemala to Congo. I mean, we can just go on to Chile. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And when will the American people say, no more of this blood on our hands, no more of killing of innocent civilians, no more, no more on our hands, no more? When will it happen? We can only hope and pray to whoever you worship, Allah, Buddha, Yahweh, what have you. When will it end? And we must, you know, pray, but we must do more than that. We must get up off our knees and take to the streets and protest and rally and engage our communities and educate them and get them to be more and more politically vigilant to demand an end to this destruction, where the epicenter of world domination and imperialism and plunder start and reside in the United States of America. Your thoughts, Tim?
Solomon, I don't think you could have said it any better. People really need to get politically engaged. And that change that you're talking about, the more civilized world, free of warmongering politicians, killing of innocent civilians, and economic starvation, that's not going to come through the Democratic or Republican parties. It's just not something we're going to see or that we've ever seen in the history of this country. So that being said, that change is only going to come from a third party and the people rising up and becoming politically active. But you, as someone who's worked for a third party yourself, I believe you said that often you heard people arguing that, you know, if I vote for a third party, I'm wasting my vote. And that discouraged them, even if they knew that they were voting for the lesser of two evils and were still voting for evil. So what is something that you could tell people that have that type of mindset?
Well, I mean, well, first of all, when if it's the Green Party, for instance, that you're supporting in the U.S., you know, and that limited, that loser type mentality where somebody says, oh, you're voting, I can't vote for someone. I like their platform, I like their policies and what they're about, but I can't bring myself to vote for somebody who has no chance of winning. I mean, you have just made yourself a big fat loser, and you need to change that mentality first and foremost. And understanding that if many people, well, most people have no idea about these third parties, but if most people knew about these third parties and decided not to vote for them based on that, I mean, they're part of the problem. But I would like to think that if most people knew about them and actually said, you know, I'm going to vote for them, it could make a tremendous difference. It could actually put some of these third parties, not just for presidential elections, but for Congress and Senate, put them right there in the mix in terms of vying for these political offices. But beyond that, if, for instance, say this, just like in 2008, we knew those of us that were, you know, pushing for Cynthia McKinney and the Green Party and Rosa Clemente, her vice presidential candidate, we knew that that even if they did not win, we knew that 5%, if we got nationwide 5% of the vote, 5% of the national vote, just 5%, if the Green Party got 5% nationwide, that would, in essence, free up valuable, important federal economic resources, money, moolah coming from the federal government that is afforded to those parties that get 5% of the national elections. And that money is forwarded to the next presidential election in 2000, you know, whatever. In this case, 2012, the Green Party would have gotten a lot of money, and I can't exactly know I think it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, it could be very well around $200,000+ that are afforded to that party's national convention. So instead of doing a, you know, small, I mean, they can actually put together, have money to put together a slam dunk, well-presented convention. Not that they didn't put together a well-presented one this time, but they would have one that would reach, that had the potential to reach and to draw in, because that resource is also will go towards mailings and all kinds of promotion. So folks know about this convention, so there's, you know, get coverage there, the whole shebang. So, and you have to think long term. You can't just think, oh man, you know, my man or woman in this presidential election is not, you know, I can't vote for someone that has no chance of winning because most people don't know about him. So therefore, I'm not going to vote for him. Vote for them anyways, because that 5% goes a long way, and you have to look at it as it is a process. It is a process. And so those conventions, not only those conventions are the nominating platforms, but those conventions also serve as good recruiting tools for midterm elections, for Congress people, for Senate. You see the importance of getting more and more voices into both houses in the U.S. Congress, you know, the Senate and the House of Representatives, but also even local elections, getting more Green Party members into mayor's offices, and as well as state delegates and state senators and those kind of things. You have to think large, but it's not easy. It takes a lot of boots on the ground, a lot of organizing. You can't consume yourself with being, you know, on Facebook and just posting, you know, radical messages or what's deemed quote unquote radical messages, and posting pictures of Che Guevara sitting next to Fidel Castro. As much as a fan as I am of both men, you have to do much more than that. You can't just simply I'm posting this strong two sentence or three sentence, you know, saying or statement that I come that comes from me or somebody else, someplace else. You can't do that, Tim. You understand what I'm saying? People cannot do that, and we see a whole bunch of Facebook revolutionaries and Twitter revolutionaries, and it's fine to post stuff if you're doing other stuff where you have the boots on the ground, all right? But there's no proxy for having meetings one-on-one or meetings in a group, whether it's 10 people or more, and meeting and organizing and saying, this is how we're gonna take back our community block by block. And then when we take back the community, we take back the state, we take back the country, and we take back humanity. You know what I'm saying? It has to start that way. But sitting on Facebook and just posting these radical images and such and such, if that's all you're doing, it amounts to really nothing. And it's not saying that everyone that goes on Facebook is doing that, because I know some good folks that use Facebook as a tool to disseminate information. But Facebook can only be something that supplements the activist work that involves boots on the ground in the community, boots on the ground organizing, meeting in your house, meeting in the basement of a church or a community center with other people, even if it's 10 people, and organizing different political expressions and actions. Even if it means, you know, organizing a political training, you know, in such and such community where people are politically trained to understand electoral politics better and understanding, you know, the contradictions of voting Democrat or Republican, and informing them how that they can work towards supporting independent candidates for local offices as well as national offices, and even creating or supporting political parties outside of the two-party dictatorship of Republicans, Democrats, that would lead itself towards, like I said, retaking communities one by one by one, and on. So I don't know if you have any closing comments. You know,
I think you pretty much said it all. I think we just have to spread this information, to our networks, so that other people are aware of this fact and that we can collectively act, which is the definition of organizing, to to bring about this change, even if it might come very slowly. We need to see this change in our community, and we need to do everything to fight for it. It will not be changed overnight, but it's the only way that we can see a change in the political climate of this country.
That's right. That's right. So I know you're ready for that work, and I know this is, as you know, this is part of it, disseminating this information. But even, you know, within this, you know, our role, as we say, with Your World News, journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive, and it's not. So we know that it's a tremendous role and importance of us folks like yourself, Tim, myself, to get out there and to spread this information by, you know, having these kind of programs. But we also know that we also have to be about getting out in the community. And for those getting that information to those folks who don't have internet access, who don't have so-called smartphones, bring that information to them. You know, man to man to man to woman, you know, woman to man to child. Bring that information to them personally, and also bring in our cameras and our microphones and actually, you know, getting the stories from those people that are in those economically and governmentally neglected communities, getting the information and covering stories and information from those individuals and those communities that are not being told by the corporate media. And that's what separates outlets like Your World News from the rest.
Exactly.
So I want to thank you, Tim. Looking forward for us to do our next show next week, and just like we did it today. You know, and you'll hear much more from Tim, as Tim is our official student correspondent for Your World News. And if you're interested, you know, for more information, please go to yourworldnews.org. That's yourworldnews.org. If you have articles or pieces that you'd like to submit, or issues that you would like to have addressed on this program, you know, let us know. Email us at solo@yourworldnews.org. That's solo@yourworldnews.org. And you can also email Tim at tim@yourworldnews.org. For Tim and everybody else that's part of the Your World News family, which includes you, the listener, take care.